It is my job to introduce Hella to you. Wow, what an easy job it is. What a great job it was. You know, I chatted up with her on the phone a few times, and do you need a ride from the airport? No, I got it covered. Would you like to go to lunch on Saturday? No, I have it covered, and I think you're going to find out why. I know there are a few friends of Hella's here today. And so it's just been a joy to spend the evening with her last night, the day today. And I'm the one that's been blessed by her presence. So it's truly an honor to introduce to you Hella, our speaker today.
Hi, I'm Hella. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon Family Groups. Just want to say thank you to Don and the committee for bringing me down here, and thank you, Elizabeth, for really, it's been lovely getting to know you. Yeah, I travel with an entourage all in Atlanta area, not normally. Although, we should really look into that. I could get used to it. No, it's very humbling, actually, and those gifts of the Al-Anon program, that's actually from one of our Al-Anon books, From Survival to Recovery. Note the word from survival to recovery. And every time I hear it, it just, it like gets me right in the somewhere, and I get all teary-eyed. So it's a, you know, we will laugh more. I love that. I heard it for the first time. We will forgive ourselves, our family, and the world. I'm like, wow, we're going to forgive the whole world. But that's how we think. That's how I think. Like, I have to forgive the entire universe. Not just the world, the entire universe. But starting with myself. Anyway, I got into Al-Anon January 2005. It's a bit murky on the exact day, so I have picked a day, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't the actual day. And interestingly, you know, I got to Al-Anon not because of someone's drinking. I got to Al-Anon because of someone's sobriety. I was like, what? Like, please drink. Before I had a sponsor, I actually said that. Please take a drink. I mean, now I'm like horrified. Like, who says that to someone trying to get sober? I did. Because it was unbearable. It was really and, you know, he had a sponsor. He was going to meetings. It wasn't like he wasn't doing the deal. I just was a loony, and I didn't know what to do suddenly. I had it all figured out, so I thought, when he was drinking. I got that down. But when he was sober, I was like, why am I not better? Like, why do I still feel exactly the same? Why do I still feel and act and behave in a manner that is unacceptable to me? He stopped drinking. I thought that was going to solve everything. I also thought when he went to rehab that, you know, he went to rehab, the first time, right before Thanksgiving, and I thought, well, surely by January we can celebrate New Year's Eve with a glass of champagne. You know? I mean, come on. I really did not get it. I did not get that he was an alcoholic. I did not get what that meant. I did not get what recovery and sobriety, I had no clue. I just wanted everything to chill out. You know, because we, you know, drinking had always been a part of our relationship. You know, and I was able to sort of like moderate and then really not drink much at all. So I just thought, just chill out and we're good. You don't have to stop. I mean, that's a little extreme, don't you think? Just slow it down, you know. Anyway, but here's how I got to that way of thinking. I grew up in a family deeply affected by alcoholism. My parents, moved from Germany in the early 70s, and my mom, her main motivation for doing that was to get away from a place that had too many bars, because her dad was an alcoholic, various other family members were alcoholics, and she thought the reason for that was that there were too many bars in the small town they lived in. In fact, I think one of her sisters and her brother-in-law, so my aunt's husband, who was also an alcoholic, owned a bar, you know. And so she was like, clearly the problem is the bars. We must leave this country, go to another country with fewer bars. I don't really, you know, but that was the logic. That's the sort of thinking of a family member affected by alcoholism. That seemed like a perfectly reasonable solution. And my dad, although not an alcoholic, certainly was affected by alcoholism. His best friend was an alcoholic, and the kind that, similar to what Jim described, would wake up and if he didn't have something to drink every 2 hours, got the shakes. And he would visit for a period, long periods of time with his wife and stay with us where I grew up. And I just observed, like, he would, like, had the, you know, really red nose and would get the shakes, and then he would sort of disappear for a little bit and come back and be fine. I was like, well, I had no idea. It turns out my parents had a fully stocked bar for some reason they never drank from, but he did. So years later, we were like, wow, this whole bar is empty. that's interesting. Oh, right. He was, you know, would sort of slip into that room where the bar stood and, you know, take care of what he needed to do. So all of that to say that I didn't grow up with someone, you know, a parent drinking. I grew up in a home deeply affected by alcoholism. So what did that look like? Well, in my family, that looked like a place where you just didn't talk about anything. You didn't talk about anything meaningful. You certainly didn't talk about how you felt. And you certainly didn't come and be vulnerable. And I know now that my parents, certainly my mom, didn't have the vocabulary or the information to know what to do with that with their children. So, you know, what you either got, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And I was like, okay, duly noted. I'm not sure what you want me to have. Okay, practical advice for living. Doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Okay, so I guess I'm getting stronger. And don't talk about that anywhere because that'll make us all look really bad. Okay, duly noted number two. So my life skills from early on were just basically don't talk about it. There's no point. No one really knows what to do with it. And certainly don't tell a stranger because it'll look bad. So I went through, you know, growing up like that. But I don't know. I mean, I was like, I must be adopted because I was always the emotional one, which in relative terms, because in the German household, that was a really restrained emotion. But I would lose it. And this is a pretty classic thing I've learned. You know, I can identify with a lot of the people I go to meetings with in Al-Anon. You know, it's like, I'll take it, I'll take it, I'll stuff it, I'll take it, I'll stuff it. And then watch out because a nuclear bomb has just exploded and I've lost my mind. 3 months later from this one thing that maybe happened that wasn't really probably a big deal, but it festered and festered. And the next thing you know, I've cleared everything off the shelf. I've broken, like, I don't know how many TV remotes, which, can I just tell you, is really annoying. Okay? When you break a TV remote, forevermore, you have to get up and change the channel. That is really a bad idea. If you're going to break something, don't do the remote thing. That was ill-advised. I broke, like, three of them. I'm like, I really should start throwing something else. I don't think that's working. So in any case, I that's the kind of, you know, environment I grew up with. It also never felt safe. I never felt safety and security, and I felt very, very alone. Just alone and sad. Like, I was a really sad kid. You know, on the surface, from the outside, there was no good reason for that. You know, lived outside of D.C., we had a pool, people were always over, you know, it seemed like, you know, these people are having a good time, this is a, you know, fun-loving household, But that was all like, you know, not even intentionally for show. That was just what you saw. But with the reality of how I felt on the inside was really sad, really, really alone, and unsupported. And again, I don't think my parents realized that. I don't think they did that intentionally. I just, that's what they knew how to do. So I made a decision around the age of 14 that, you know, my parents also did make us go to church every Sunday, and, you know, I was like, all right, I'll play along. And so that was one more place where I had to do, you know, present the family front, like all is well, robot. And but I always had this feeling, I'm like, I feel like I should, like there should be some connection here to this God, this higher power we're all here to talk about every Sunday. And I didn't. I felt nothing, and I felt deserted and alone, and abandoned. So I made a decision, and I remember making that decision in that, you know, in the pew itself, and I said, in my head, I quietly said to God, I said, you know, it's all good. I got this. I don't need your services, because I don't really think there are any services to be had here. I'll take over. Well, so that was a good idea. Not. So once I've made that decision, you know, now the wheels really get wobbly. And I'm 14. And I'm the troubled child. When I went through my mom's things in her apartment, I found this book titled something like, What to Do with Your Troubled Daughter. And I was like, oh, really? There was a book for that. And it had earmarks. And, you know, I made a decision in that moment not to look through it. I was like, you know, I'm going to respect her privacy. This was okay, like a few years ago. So I had a lot of recovery on my belt. But I made that decision to not look through that book and check out which pages she'd earmarked and what notes she might have made. I just donated it. Or maybe I threw it away. I don't know. I got rid of it, and I didn't look inside of it. In any case, you know, one of the ways that I thought I could control life and myself was that I stopped breathing. Yes. So I figured out that I could hyperventilate myself to such a state of passing out. And I also discovered the upside to that was I would get a lot of attention. Because you pass out and the ambulance has to come, everyone is paying attention. So I did, you know, I started with, oh, I just feel so overwhelmed, and I would hyperventilate, and then I would pass out, essentially stop myself breathing. And, you know, after a few trips to the hospital and all this amazing attention I suddenly was getting, I was like, ooh, this is a design for living. This is a good deal. I figured it out, guys. Like, just create a dramatic situation and you will get what you need. Don't ask for it or, like, talk it through or, like, you know, work it out. You know. No. Do something kind of crazy, draw a lot of attention, and you'll get what you need. So I did this on and off for several years. So whenever I felt really uncomfortable, or I felt especially alone in the world, or I felt misunderstood, that was my go-to. I would just stop breathing. And, I mean, my mom was just, like, completely, like, you know, this was really traumatic for her. And so the solution that we all came to together was, because we didn't talk about it, by the way. No one said, not even the doctors, although one doctor was like, I don't know if this is a medical condition, you know, because they would put me on, like, all these meds that I didn't take because I knew I didn't actually need them. Also a doctor now. I have many degrees in all sorts of subjects. Anyway, but one doctor one time did say something along the lines, like, I'm not sure this is medical.
Yeah, right.
And nobody took that and ran with it. They were like, Anyway, you know, like, on to, like, the medical treatment. So in any case, we all decided that the best solution for this was that I should go to boarding school. So basically now I've got what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Don't talk about what's happening here to anyone because it'll make us look bad. And if it all when all else fails, move. Okay. So that's my toolbox, those three strong ideas. So excellent, I'm fully prepared for life. Oh, and I'm still in charge. So I go to boarding school. I won't lie, I was really happy. I was like, woohoo, like I'm all over here on my own and this is awesome. And then, you know, simultaneously my dad was ailing in ailing health. It was a very slow decline, his health. And I graduated from high school. I came back to the States, and I went to college, you know, not too far from where I lived so that I could visit frequently to see him because he was, you know, slowly, you know, he was in a slow decline, but we were very close and he was the one person who had any kind of emotional capacity, so like he would often be the one who would cry with me. Some of that was really totally inappropriate. I will say that, and I've had to work through that in my recovery. Some of that verged on sexual abuse, not overtly so, but certainly abusive. So, you know, for anyone who has that, I'd be happy to chat with you later. But all I will say is that, you know, I learned with him, you know, bad love is better than no love. And I'll take the attention any way I can get it. And so, and, you know, he's at least, all this other stuff is not great about what he's doing here, but the fact that he will cry with me and let me have a moment, that's good enough. Like, I'll take that. So anyway, this is how I graduate college and I burst into the scene of New York because I'm fully equipped to like take on the Big Apple. And I really, my intention for moving to New York was I'm going to move to a really big city because, and especially a place where I'll find some characters. I need more characters in my life. Like total freaks and weirdos that I can like get with and get, you know, hide behind. And, you know, we can just go do strange things all over New York City. And we did. And so I get to New York and I work as a, catering sale, an events planner for a catering company. And in the course of that, I was catering a large fragrance launch. And I see this guy across the room who's wearing like a vintage leather coat, patchwork leather coat. His hair is bleached. It looks like an exploding Q-tip. And I'm like, wow, like who's that guy? That guy looks awesome. He really stood out. I mean, you could always find him in a crowd. Like, oh, there's, you know, you just look for the hair. And you're like, oh, there he goes, you know. So very easy to keep track of. So, you know, the night of the event, he was also working on the event in a different capacity. So at the night of the event, all we were serving was white wine and some weird iced tea drink and water. And that was not hard enough for him. So he, you know, he's sort of complaining to me like, ugh, I mean, really, is that all there is to drink at this party? Like, I mean, I could really go for a vodka. And I'm like, hold on. So I popped to the back where I had a box just for VIPs, and I had a box of all the hard liquors, and I poured a enormous tumbler of straight vodka, and I brought it out, and I'm like, how's this? And he shot it back, and he's like, perfect. And I thought, wow, I mean, whew. Be still, my beating heart. I have arrived. This guy is awesome. That is so cool. I thought that was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. It was not hard to impress me, apparently. In any case, I then proceeded to make him my boyfriend because literally that night he was not interested, but I was immediately very interested. And so you know, he like, this is like a class, so this is a classic scene of like what was to come and play itself out in various ways for several years. You know, he sort of like takes off from this party. I'm like running out, behind, like sort of tailing behind, you know, get to the street. And then I see him and like, I don't know, whoever else, like driving off in a limo, like popping out of the sunroof. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, this is just so exciting. But I knew where they were going. Now, they had not invited me. They just took off because no one was thinking about, you know, hella should come. But I was like, I'm coming to this party. I know where you're going. I overheard you with my radar ears. Nothing gets past me. So I just show up at this other place they went to, and they were like, oh, hi. I was like, hi, everybody. How you doing? Like I was invited. Anyway, so that kind of, you know, that hot pursuit that of mine was sort of played out over several years. But it was that was the beginning of my mission to make him my boyfriend, which I did succeed. And then, you know, once I had done that, I was like, I really think you should move into my apartment. Here's my keys. Here's my credit card. Here's my debit card. Just, you know, come live here. Okay. And he was happy to do that. So he moved in. And then a few months after that, I'm like, we really should get engaged. I really think we should do that. Because, see, I'm thinking I need someone to follow. I need someone who's doing all the things that I might think of doing, but I would never do myself. And I don't want to really take, like, have that responsibility or be held responsible for this behavior, but I really like being very close to it so I can enjoy all the benefits of it without any of the responsibility. So you go do you all crazy wackadoo, and I'll just sort of stand here, and when it gets a little too hot, I can be like, no, one me. But while you're doing it, I get to enjoy the insane ride of it all. This is how I solve, you know, my life's problems. I'm just going to find a person, hide behind them, blame everything on them, you know, but while the going is good, I'll enjoy all the benefits of it. So, meanwhile, for some reason at this point, I'm not doing the whole, like, not breathing thing. Somehow that no longer served, it didn't serve a purpose anymore because now I had this guy. I'm like, I can get a lot of attention this way. So anyway, we get engaged, and shortly after that, my father passes away. And that was extremely painful. I got that phone call, and all I could do was let out this scream. And it was in that moment that I made another decision, which was, you know, I'm going to put my will and my life into the care of this guy, my fiancé. So this better work. This has to work. And at all costs, I will ensure that he is a success because my life now, in my mind, literally depends on him. So how he's doing determines how I'm doing. Whether he's okay means whether or not I'm okay. If he's happy, I'm happy. If he's sad, I'm sad. Like, we are now one amoeba entity. Like, I would just, like, attach myself, like, with claw hooks onto him. I mean, really, and he was like, whoa, like, what happened here? Like, he was not even fully present to make any decisions about that. And I didn't ask him. I just decided for him. I'm like, oh, this is happening. I decided it for him. So, you know, that was, like, so now I'm like, okay, I don't need to be, I don't, you know, there's no higher power, there's no God. I'm not really in charge either anymore, but he is, this guy. And so all focus, all energy on him. And so if he likes something, I like it. If he doesn't like something, I don't like it. You know, and it was like that sort of developed gradually, but it was a very strong thing. So in any case, My father dies. This, you know, we get married. He didn't want to get married. He wanted to, like, you know, cancel the wedding. And I said, who knew? This is happening. I've got too many people coming. I've got a dress. Like, don't, you know, we can do this. So, and that was the other pattern, you know. Like, I would sort of get him into, like, no, you're doing this. And then when he would try and say, I can't do this, I would say, yes, you can. And I would make it my mission to make sure he did. So we get married. We're in the entertainment business at this point. He's doing live shows. We're touring. And we're traveling all over the country. And so the other sort of snapshot of what it was like was that we would travel, you know, either domestically or internationally. We would get somewhere, start drinking. I usually drank with him, but just a little bit, not so much, like just to keep up, just to be where he was. He would drink. We would get into a fight. We would start screaming. We would argue all night. We would talk divorce about 2 a.m. Then by 5 a.m., we were like, yep, definitely getting a divorce. When we get home, we are done. That is, we're donezies. And then we would sleep for 2 hours before getting ready for the shows. Wake up and go, all right, so anyway, what do you want for breakfast? Like, that didn't happen. And we did that night after night, city after city, over and over again. We lived in a really small New York apartment. We had people in and out of there all the time. Like, I didn't think that any of this was abnormal. I didn't think that any of this was alcoholic. I didn't think there was any problem with any of this. This was just a lot of fun with some annoying side effects like all this fighting and arguing. Well, the fighting and arguing went from, you know, just your bog standards screaming and yelling to, oh, I'm going to kick you. No, I'm going to punch you. And it was both ways. So it accelerated pretty quickly where the verbal assaults that we would inflict upon each other quickly became physical. And, you know, there was a hole, like he punched a hole in the wall at one point. Now, again, we had people over all the time. We never bothered. We didn't even try to patch it. We didn't try and put a painting over it. We're like, yeah, just a hole in the wall. It's like, isn't that everybody have one of those in their home? And then my favorite one is the orange in the doorknob. So our doorknob broke the bathroom. In a New York apartment, well, older ones especially, the bathroom is basically in the kitchen, okay? So there's not a lot of room. So anyway, the doorknob breaks off, and instead of going to get another doorknob, we had a box of tangerines sitting there. So I was like, I took a tangerine, stuck it in the hole where the doorknob should be. I'm like, done. Like, and that was only because someone came over. I mean, but until then, we would just left the hole there, because who cares? But someone was coming over, like, oh, we must look presentable. Quick, put a tangerine in the doorknob. So, and then, of course, you know, tangerines start getting moldy. So I just replaced it with a new tangerine. I'm like, did you get the tangerines at the store? Yeah, okay, good. I need to put a new one in the doorknob. Well, I mean, just go get a doorknob, right? No, that would have been, like, way too simple. So in any case, this is just, you know, this just keeps going on and on and on. And around 2003, he goes to rehab for the first time. Now, this was preceded by, you know, I'd be at work, I'd get phone calls, you know, he's threatening to kill himself, and I'm at work trying to just pretend. Again, everything's fine, don't let anybody know, don't say anything to anyone, because how would that look? So I was alone in all of this. Like, nobody, I didn't talk to anybody about what was going on. I didn't talk to them about the fact that I would hit him. I didn't talk to anyone that he would hit me. I didn't talk to anyone about the fact that I yelled at him and called him all kinds of names and would just tear him down. Nobody knew that stuff. Nobody knew what he would say to me. Nobody knew how much he drank. Nobody knew anything, because I would leave my apartment and I'd be like, la, 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 everything's fine. How you doing? Fine, fine. What's going on? Nothing. Or what's going on? Well, he's blah, 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 right? So he goes to rehab. There's a family day. I go to that and I was just like, overwhelmed. I'm like, I don't even know what these people are talking about. So with two more years was like that, and you know, when he was drinking, I mean, and he, you know, part of my story is that he's been in and out of sobriety for many, many years. So he hasn't had a drink for about 9. But previous to that, he was in and out all the time. And so but this was the first time he was sober, and I thought, like, well, surely now we will be nice to each other. Surely now we will treat each other well. Surely now I'll be happy because he's calmed down. No, it was worse because now he wasn't drinking. He was constantly at meetings, and I was alone at home and still mad as hell. And so I would follow him to AA meetings. I'm like, well, I'll just make sure he's going. So instead of following him to bars to see where he was and calling the phone tree if anyone had seen him, I would go to AA meetings and follow him there. Until one day his sponsor came up to me and was like, listen, lady. You really need to go to Al-Anon. And I'm like, no, those people are boring. I'm sorry. I do not want to sit in a room with a bunch of Al-Anon ladies talking about their alcoholics. I am not interested. I want to be here. He's like, well, you don't have a problem with drinking. He does. And he needs to be here. But he needs to actually be here. You need to go to an Al-Anon meeting. So, you know, of course I was like, stupid sponsor guy, whatever. And but then I thought about it a little bit, and I thought, all right, fine. So I went to my first Al-Anon meeting. Oh, and I was seeing a drug and alcohol counselor at this time. I'm not sure why, because I didn't have a drug or alcohol problem, but it was someone that my husband had worked with, of course, after rehab. So, you know, she kept saying, you know, there's an Al-Anon meeting happening. And I'm like, yeah, whatever, lady, with your Al-Anon. I'm here to talk about drugs and alcohol. I was just like, okay, but you don't have a problem with drugs and alcohol. I'm like, well, he does. She's like, yeah, but you do not. And I was like, so? He does. Anyway, so I did go to an Al-Anon meeting, and I sat in that room, and this was the first time I'd ever heard anyone describe me. And I was like, there's a lot of us out there. I'm not the only one. And I was also like, why are these people talking about these things? Don't they know you're not supposed to talk about this stuff because it'll look bad? What will people think? So I didn't speak for months. I just would go to meetings and I would sit there and I would be horrified by all of this going on. I got all the books, and I read all the books, and I memorized all the books, and I could say anything that was written in a book, and I chaired a newcomers meeting. Somehow they let me do that, like a total loon. But, right, I was like, oh, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Don't talk about it. And if something isn't comfortable, just leave. But for some reason, I stayed. I just kept going. Now, I did go in a little late every time, and I left a little early because I didn't really want to be there, and I didn't really want you to know me, and I really didn't want you to talk to me. But I was there. But I didn't have a sponsor for like 2 years. And I studied all the books. And finally, there came a point. You know, I was going to meetings, was in Al-Anon for about 2 years, and I would wake up every morning. I would go to bed every night praying for death. Now, I wasn't going to do anything because I was like, I'm too lazy to actually figure out, like, how to kill myself, and that seems like a lot of work, but it would be really nice if I didn't wake up. So I kind of, like, suddenly I'm like, oh, God, by the way, could you just not let me wake up? So I wanted God to be responsible for me not waking up. So again, I was wanting someone else to do the thing for me. And I did that for like 6 months, and I was just a zombie. I would walk through life not really there. And, you know, he's recovering, not recovering. He's sober, not sober, you know, all over the place. We're still fighting. Nothing has really changed. I'm telling him, please drink, like crazy stuff. And I'm wanting to just die. And so I'm like, I think I might need a sponsor. I think maybe I need to actually do this thing. So I started asking people to sponsor me, and everybody said no. And I was like, well, that's not right. And some people were like, well, I already have one sponsee, or I'm really busy, or something like that, right? Or maybe they just thought, not this lady. I don't. But finally, I heard a woman share at an anniversary meeting, and she described a story so terrible, like, that I thought my story was nothing compared to hers. She described something so horrible, and there she was, like, laughing and full of life and, like, joy and amazing, like, spirit. And I was like, whatever that lady did, I want that. I will do that because I want whatever that thing there that I'm watching, I want that. So I ran up to her after the meeting, and I basically pummeled her, and I was like, you need to be my sponsor. And all these other people were lined up, and I just was like, listen, no. Like, you are not going to get this lady to be your sponsor. Because I was terrified. She was like, no, I'm sorry. Now I'm busy. I got these other people, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, she said, okay, here's what you're going to do. You're going to call me every day. You're going to go to 3 meetings a week. You're going to get a home group. You're going to get a service position at that home group. Try to get to at least one of those meetings a week with me so I can hear you share, you can hear me share. And we're going to work the steps, get a big book, read the big book so you learn about alcoholism. And then we're just going to do the steps. And I was like, yes, man. So, you know, I at this point was desperate, because I did not know how to live. All the things that I thought would bring me joy and happiness and fulfillment, none of it was working. All my great ideas were going nowhere fast. And he was not, he was all over the place. And so, you know, my behavior was still completely unacceptable. And I'd been going to meetings for 2 years. So I was like, whatever this lady tells me to do, I'm going to do it. And I'm really grateful for the gift of, I was very willing. And I was as honest as I could be at that time. But I was very, very, very willing, and I was open to anything. So she got me right into the steps. We worked really hard. We did a lot of recovery on the subway to and fro Manhattan from Brooklyn. Like, we'd have a meeting, she and I, like, doing step work or whatever. Or I was like, I'm feeling crazy. She's like, no kidding. I'm on my way to work. It's 7:30 in the morning. I'm on my way to work on the, you know, you can join me on the subway. I'm like, I'll be there. So I would, like, hop on the subway. She lived one stop away from me. And I would just ride that subway. I had no reason to be in Manhattan. I just rode the subway into with her, talk, get some good orderly direction, and then, like, take the subway back. And I did that a lot. Like, one time she was doing some, not marathon, but like a walk, a benefit walk. And it was like, I didn't know going to be a 7-hour walk. But she's like, well, I'm really busy, but if you want to come with me on this walk, like through Central Park, like, you're welcome to join me. And I was like, I'm there. And then I meet her at like 7 in the morning, and I'm like, ready to walk. And, you know, because this is the time I can get with my sponsor. And so we're walking. I'm like, walking and walking. I'm still talking, and she's like, oh my God, you know, this lady will not shut up. And I'm like, God, another thing and whatever. And, you know, we're walking, and I'm like, wait, how long is this walk exactly? And I mean, 8 hours later, I was sideways, because she was started halfway through. She's like, I'm going to give this girl the business. So she's like wagging the finger and, like, you know, but, like, it's exactly what I needed at the time. And, you know, she taught me all about how to love. Like, she just loved me. She would give me these hugs and then do the extra squeeze thing at the end, like, and she'd make this noise. And I'm like, what is this weird hugging thing, and why are you squeezing me, and why are you making that noise, you know? But because I'm like, what is this hug thing? What is this? I'd never been hugged, I realized. Not like that. I love greeters now. I love being a greeter. because I get to hug people. I'm really good at hugging now. I was a terrible hugger. I didn't even think to hug you because I didn't know that was a thing. Like, I didn't know you could do that, right? So she taught me how to hug, and she just loved up on me. And she just loved me until I could love myself, right? And the other women, you know, that she sponsored, and the other women in the meetings, and then all, and then suddenly she's like, oh, I'm from Atlanta, and there's a bunch of other women down there. And I'm like, yee-haw! So, like, we go, you know, we started coming down here. I mean, we went to conventions and conferences and retreats. I mean, wherever she said to go, I was like, got my ticket, you know, got my ticket. Because I had chased him all over the world. I had chased him and fought tooth and nail with him all those years. So now I was just going to chase this thing with the same gusto, the same passion, and the same desperation as I chased him. And I'll never regret having done any of that to this day. I still do it. I mean, I'm here this weekend. I'll go anywhere. You ask me, I will be there. I will go anywhere. If anyone reaches out for help, I will be there. I will answer that phone call. I will every time. Because I still need to do this. Like, I didn't graduate. You know, in the last 5 years, I know I'm sort of all over the place, but I did make a decision, thankfully, finally, to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, as I understood him then. And my understanding of God at the time I did my third step for the first time is very different from my understanding of who God is today. I will say that. Like, my God has had to continue to grow. But once I made that decision that first time to turn my will, my life back over to the care of God as I understood him then, my life changed. It didn't get any easier, not for a long, long time, but it changed. Now, I was still doing nutty things, making crazy decisions, still pulling geographics, like, let's move to New Mexico for 4 years. Like, why? Everybody I tell that to, like, what? Like, why? You went from New York to the desert? Yeah. Why? Not really sure. I think he wanted to go there. So, right, like, even in recovery, even with all of that, I still made decisions based on what would make him happy and not really consider what would make me happy. Anyway, we did finally move back from New Mexico 5 years ago, back to Virginia, where I work for the family business, which means my brother is my boss. My brother, someone just last week was telling me, who's known him for a long time, that, anyway, it's a long story why she would know this, but she's like, yeah, and then, you know, I mean, your mom really had her hands full, like, you know, with you, and I'm like, thanks. And then also, you know, your brother, I mean, he went to rehab, and I was like, wait, what? What? Yeah, she found some drugs in his drawer, and, you know, rehab, and I was like, what? So I didn't know that. I mean, his drinking has always kind of bothered me. Actually, let me put it this way. He has a personality change when he drinks. But his personality change is actually much, he's more pleasant when he drinks than he is when he's not drinking. I actually prefer, because he's like friendly and jovial and chatty. When he's not drinking, he's not any of those things. So it still bothers me because I'm like, oh, I can see it in the eyeballs. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, and that's cool. Like, I love him, but I'm like, okay, like, note to self, right? So I don't know if, I mean, he's never said, oh, I'm an alcoholic, but I mean, let's, you know, I'm putting sort of two and two together here. And it would certainly explain a lot of things. So we moved back, you know, 5 years ago, and I started working for him. And the whole story about that was insane. Turns out that the reason God had us move back at that particular time was because a year after we moved back, my mother passed away during heart surgery. And because, right, my solution was to run away, when I moved away, I moved away. And I had very little contact. I had a lot of contact with her, but I had very little contact in general with my family. And when I moved to New Mexico, it was really hard for her to come there because of altitude and her heart issues. So when we moved back, she announced, Hella, I will be coming over every Tuesday night, and I will sleep at your house, yeah? I'm like, okay, yeah, I'm not going to argue with you, okay. And she's like, and then I will drive back the next day. And I'm like, okay. So I said, Sage, just FYI, my husband, my mom's going to be spending every Tuesday night here. And he was like, oh, okay. I'm like, you know, we have no say in the matter. This is happening. So, and the interesting thing about that is that my husband had gotten really badly injured on the job in New Mexico. So when we got back to Virginia, he was pretty much incapacitated, a traumatic brain injury. He had a broken back and neck. And my mom had all these issues. And so she would start coming home from work earlier and earlier every Tuesday. And they would have this little health regimen going on. And they would both shuffle. One time I came home and I was like, what's happening in this house, okay? So he's shuffling over this way. She's shuffling over the other way. He had these, like, massage roller things. She's like, she would, like, massage roller on his back. And he was, and then she goes, and now you do to me, yes? And he was like, okay. So they became these, like, two little healing buddies. I mean, that was a beautiful, like, moment in recovery. Like, that was, like, when we talk about see and share love, I got to see some love there. Like, with the words, I love you, never uttered between them. But that was a lot of love going on there, a lot of love and care. And it's because I learned how to hug people here that I could hug her. And she was like me, was like, you could feel her whole body, like, clench. She was like, oh, my God, don't touch me. Oh, please, don't hug me. And you'd be like, ooh, I'm going to hug you. And then you'd hug her, and she would relax into it. Like, she didn't even know she needed that, right? Just like I didn't know I needed that. But once I learned how to do it here, I'm like, oh, I am doing this everywhere. Woo! Mom, get over here. So, anyway, Mom spent a lot of time with us. And, you know, when she passed away on the operating table, I actually, like, for a minute, I was like, what could I have done? What could I have done? I mean, I was in the waiting room, but I'm like, I should have yelled at those doctors more. I should have called back to the OR more often and, like, made them fix her. I couldn't do that. Thankfully, because of this program, I knew that. Like, I had that thought. My first thought came into my head, like, you didn't do enough, Hella, to save your mother's life. My second thought was, she's with God. God took her home. Had nothing to do with you. And I'm so grateful that I could think that way now. I mean, I still have that first thought. But my second thought and my sponsor's voice on the phone were like, no, it's okay. I let her go and God took her. But I got to say I love you to her. And she'd just go, But I got to do that. And then last year when my brother, right, so my brother and I have this weird, not weird, alcoholic relationship. And so last year he was diagnosed with terminal leukemia, well, pretty much terminal leukemia, out of nowhere. And they were like, yeah, come to the hospital right now because if you don't and we don't get you plugged into this stuff, like, you have 6 weeks to live. So, you know, I got to walk through that with him. I got to show up. I got to go to the hospital and sit with him. I got to love him in the way that he could receive, which took some doing. I had a lot of help from my sponsor and others because I wanted to be like, and now we're going to be best friends and quick. Like, let's have a relationship we've never had before. Woo! And I'm ready for it, aren't you? And he was like, yeah, I'm still who I am. And I'm like, oh, right. So, but I got to learn how to love him from a distance. You know, even though we work together and we don't live that far apart, but I got to learn to love him in the way that he could receive it, which most of the time means I just think lovingly in his general direction. And I write him cards to tell him how I feel because he doesn't do well with person-to-person chatting. Like, that's really hard for him. Like, he'll email me, and I'll write him cards, and we just do that. And while in my mind I'm like, but I want us to have a heart-to-heart, and I want to sit down, and let's talk about our feelings, and like, blah, 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 right? My amends to him is to just love him from over here in a way that he can receive, because that's loving him. And now the other thing is, you know, my husband, he and I have, you know, we've really turned that around. Whew. We treat each other with dignity and respect. I love him. I got to learn how to care for him, like when he was really sick. And even then, I had a lot of step one, like, resentments. Like, why are you in bed with injuries you didn't cause? You should be walking, you know. It was not rational, but that's what happens when I feel powerless, whether it's someone's drinking or other kinds of behavior or an illness, any kind of illness or any kind of injury. When I feel powerless, I get angry. Still today, I just get mad. I get mad at the universe. I just get mad because I want it to be different. And I think still in some little piece of my back of my head that if I just get mad enough at you and tell you all about it, you know, it'll change. Well, I know that's not true. I know that's not true. But today, you know, there's no yelling in our house. No one has raised a hand or a foot or a leg or whatever to kick someone, however you put that. And I don't know how long. There's a lot of respect and love. He calls me his queen. I call him my love, my love. That is not what we called each other for a long time. Not at all. Those were four-letter words that I won't repeat here. But that's how we talk to each other now. When we were looking at calendars, and, you know, he's now, like, out of bed, functional, thriving, building a business. And so he's traveling for work a lot. He goes up to New York once a month for a week. And we were sitting down to do our calendars, and so this is a great, like, this is like a classic, this is recovery. This example is my little recovery vignette. So we're sitting there combined, you know, talking calendars, and I'm putting in like all the times he's here and there. And you know, a tear starts to roll down my eye because I'm getting upset. Because I'm like, he's not ever going to be home, and he's going to move on from me. And I mean, crazy. It's all in my head. Now, I'm not, thank God, I didn't say any of these things out loud. But I'm just sitting there like, putting things in my calendar. And so I'm like, but I'm like, really like, I'm all worked up over this. I'm like, oh my gosh, how are we going to do this? Like, how is this going to work? And then. So he looks at me, he's like, why are you crying? And I'm like, I'm not going to talk about that with you right now. I'm going to go call my sponsor. He was like, okay. So he knows better than to press, right? So within a couple of days, I did talk to my sponsor, and I'm like, I think I need to do some step work. So she had me do a fourth and fifth step. And in that, I was like, oh, I'm also gone a lot. Like, I'm in Alatoon, and then I'm going to this, and then I'm going to this other thing. And like, oh, actually, I'm gone a lot in the next few months. It's not all him. So I was like, ooh, selfish, self-seeking. I'm like, well, at least it doesn't say dishonest and fear as much. This is progress. Progress. So, you know, but the fact that it would even upset me that we wouldn't have that much time together is also a miracle. There was a time when we were like, yeah, basically living under the same roof but as separate entities. Where we were like, thank God that person's not home. Right? So now it's like, oh, wow, I actually miss you. I enjoy your company. It's pleasant to be with you. Wow, that's love. But, you know, I couldn't bring that love into my home and be caring and sweet to him if I hadn't learned it with the women in Al-Anon, with the women and men of AA. I couldn't have done that. I watched you guys hug each other, laugh together, encourage each other, right? And my sponsor said the most amazing thing to me when we did that fifth step. That was just a few weeks ago. She said, you know, you have a lot of courage. And I was like, what? Get out of here. No, really, you have a lot of courage. And I'm just going to sit and absorb that. I have a lot of courage. And she said, it takes courage to write these things down on paper and tell someone else what it says. That takes a lot of courage. And she said, you know, we all, every single person, every time we go into a meeting, every time we do some writing, we are being courageous. And that serenity prayer talks about, right, the courage to change the things I can. So the word courage is just all over the place, but I had never thought of that. But I'm like, and then I was like, sort of like, hey, I have a lot of courage, you know, yeah, go me, okay, in a good way, right? I was like, yeah, wait a second, I have a lot of courage. Huh, I had not thought of myself as a particularly courageous person myself. Maybe others thought this about me, but I did not think that way of myself. So I was like, well, I've got some courage. That's awesome. So then I started out my sponsees. I'm like, hey, you've got a lot of courage. And they were like, what? I'm like, I know. Isn't that cool? You've got a lot of courage. So I'm like, oh, I get to pass this on. Right? I get to pass it on to the next person because I didn't get to hear those things growing up. I didn't get to hear, I love you. I didn't get to hear, you have a lot of courage. I didn't get to hear, you can do anything. I didn't get to hear, it's okay. It'll be all right. This too shall pass. Nobody said these things. They just said, oh, well, if it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger. I'm like, what do you do with that? What do you do with that? It's not comforting. It makes a lot of pressure, actually, to, like, just grin and bear it. But I learned that here, and I get to now love other people the way that I was loved. And now I know how. That's amazing. That is an amazing miracle of this program. I no longer have to move when I'm uncomfortable. I can just travel more. That was another dime. My sponsor was like, you know, like a few years ago, I'm like, I think I should really move back to New York. I mean, this, like, small town Virginia, I cannot. And she was like, or you could just travel more. I'm like, oh, you mean I don't have to blow up my entire world, relocate, pack and move again because I'm uncomfortable. I can just sit on my hands and do nothing and do the next right thing and then just travel more? She's like, yeah. I'm like, oh. And you know what? I've been doing that ever since. It's a fabulous alternative. But that's because I can't think of those things on my own, right? When I turn my will and my life over to the care of God, I'm also turning it over to the flow. I'm turning it over to God bringing to me the people, the ideas, the thoughts, the, like, alternatives, the perspective that I on my own cannot have. I cannot see. I don't have it in me. I don't have it. So I need other people to sort of weigh in on the situation and just offer an alternative. And then I can go, oh, wow, that's actually pretty cool. So I want to close with this one thing about courage. Courage doesn't always roar. Sometimes courage is the quiet voice at the end of the day saying, I will try again tomorrow. Thank you very much. Wow.